Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Verbal Shenanigans. A beautiful day to be alive and a beautiful episode coming your way. Episode 198, almost at 200, guys. But I want to tell you about the sponsors real quick before we begin. We're lucky enough to work with some small businesses that we are very proud to have on board. So one of them happens to be Demented Brewing. Demented Brewing is located in Middlesex, New Jersey, right off of Route 287. It has one of the coolest tap rooms, barrel programs, sour programs, 16 different rotating taps. They put different things in the tun on Tuesday. They also just have they just got their own canning line. So they just four packs of Scarlet Knight are going out in the tasting room as we speak. So go check out Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey. Insanely flavorful ales. We happen to be lucky enough to have two brewery sponsors. The other one happens to be Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown, New Jersey, in the old bank building. They have a Cinco de Mayo beer coming out called Maize, M-A-I-Z-E. It's a Mexican lager, which is made with corn, hence the name. Manskirt Brewing, a very cool place to chill, have a beer, relax, play some games. They have rotating taps all the time. It's a really neat place. So go check out Joe Fisher in his Manskirt and give them some love on social media at Manskirt Brewing. Wolf Nation, that stands up for Wake Up Live Free Apparel. This is the world's next hottest and biggest designer brand. No matter what your goals in life are, as long as you are pursuing it, that is Wolf Nation's motto. Wake up, live free. Follow them on Instagram, where they're currently taking pre-orders through DM at Wolf Nation, or you can email them at wolf@wolfnation, or go check out their new website at wolfnation.rocks. They're introducing spring wolf wear for both men, women, also accessories, hats, bags, mugs, so all sorts of things. It's a really cool entrepreneur putting out great clothing, designer clothing, and I think you will like Wolf Nation. Wake up, live free. Susan Robb is one of our sponsors out of Toronto, Canada. Susan works with senior executive in leadership development and also runs a business as a speaker agent for some pretty cool speakers that we've had on our show. Dave Andershuk, Coach Jim Johnson. She worked with a gal named Kim Ward from Wisconsin, and Kim was a guest on our show a few months back. Susan and Kim are working on this great project where they're tirelessly advocating and raising money to inspire and empower a group of women and kids in Nepal. So far, their efforts have raised enough money to put 14 kids into school for the very first time and help the group of ladies start a sewing business. They make these beautiful quilts. You got to check them out. It's a great business to support. 13 quilts have already been made, shipped and sold in four countries, and all proceeds go right back into their Nepal outreach program into the next phase of sustainability. So go check out their GoFundMe at /Vimla, V-I-M-L-A, or say hi to Susan Robb, R-O-B-B, on Twitter. Finally, Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer, every week in beer bars and breweries all over New Jersey, we host trivia. I host the Tap House 15, where we also run the comedy shows. So go check them out. You could be in last place, win prizes. It's just a good night out. Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. What a show we got for you today. Today on the show, we have the one and only from ESPN Radio and New York Sports, various New York Sports broadcasting, the one and only Don LaGreca. You may know him from the Michael Kay Show. So it was a pleasure to talk to him, also a Ramapo alumni. And we have a guy by the name of John Fryer, who's been a producer on with such bands as Depeche Mode, Nine Inch Nails, and just that's just to name a few. Go check out his laundry list of stuff. Both guys were really awesome and a lot of fun to talk to. So with that, guys, enjoy the podcast.
Hey, this is Don LaGreca. You're listening to Verbal Shenanigans, something I know a lot about.
Hey, this is John Fryer from Black Needle Noise, and you're listening to Verbal Shenanigans.
But our shenanigans are cheap and fun. Yeah, I mean, your shenanigans are cool and tragic. Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Welcome back to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans podcast, and we have a great one for you today. I don't know that. I'm just saying that I'm assuming that it's going to be great because, obvi, as they say, as they all say. But it's been a crazy week, and I want to get right into it, and I'm going to call the Georgia Peach himself, Mike Berlow. Let's get the co-host on the line.
I got you mid-laugh there. I guess I missed the whole irony.
Hey, caller. It's welcome to Verbal Shenanigans Radio. It's we got dogs barking and zaniness up in the Z Morning Zoo on Verbal Shenanigans. Caller, what can I do for you?
This isn't Pizza Hut.
Caller, what is the phrase that pays on this Tuesday evening, Verbal Shenanigans style?
Flop ear.
Sorry, no idea what flop ear means. Let's go to the next caller. We got another caller. Line two, caller, what are you calling for?
Is it Hot and Crazy Kids?
Hot and Crazy Kids, show me. Oh, all right, let's go to caller three. It's Mike from Georgia. Mike from Georgia. Is this Michael from Georgia? Welcome to the show.
I prefer the Burles, Scotty, as I told your producer.
Hang up with this guy. This guy has no clue what he's talking about. I've been doing this for 25 years. He's calling himself the Burles. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous behavior, and he has no ideas what he's talking about. No ideas. Me and Dog did this a long time ago. Mike from Georgia, you got 2 seconds. Go.
Is it Fortnite, the phrase?
Fortnite is the winner. You're going to the Super Bowl, buddy. You're going to the Super Bowl. Mike, how are you?
Doing well. Yourself, sir?
It's a little crazy. So I'm a little goofy at the moment. A little kind of overly stressed, I guess. And I don't really get too stressed. Just busy. But I guess I'll jump right into it. Last Friday, okay, our landlords, okay, so we're renting this little tiny place here in New Jersey, where many a podcast has gone down. Mm-hmm. Our landlords say, hey, you know, like a couple of days before that, they're like, hey, are you guys going to be around for like a year or so? And, you know, we love you. You guys are great tenants. We'd love you to be around, whatnot. And we're like, okay, yeah, we had started looking at a couple different places, maybe to potentially buy or just to see what's out there, because we really like our neighborhood. We really do. This is where we envision staying. This is where we envision settling down. It's a good neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. So we're like, yeah, you know, we'll probably stay here until we get married and whatnot and stay in the place. And the rent's not too bad, and, you know, it doesn't have much space, but we made it work, and it's, you know, we're kind of comfortable at this point. And, you know, moving sucks. That's what it comes down to. So you know very well. Yep. You know very well. You just moved whatever it is, eight states away or whatever the hell it is, but far away, and packing sucks and all that. And we had just moved to about 2 years ago or whatever it was. So flash forward Friday night, they say, hey, come on over our place. We want to talk to you about some options for the house, and we think it'd be a great opportunity for you and all this stuff. Okay, so we're like, all right, because we had always said that this place would be, you know, possibly cool to buy and you know, renovate the whole thing. You know, because of the property. The property we're on is cool. The house is nothing. It's very tiny. But the property we're on is on the water. So that's always cool.
Yeah.
And peaceful and nice. And there's only so many lake view houses, if you will. So they're talking to us. We get there and they're feeding us pizza. She gives us pizza. She sits us down. She's like, you know, we really want you guys to be, you know, our tenants, or maybe we could do a rent-to-own kind of thing. You know, if you couldn't afford it right away, you could rent, and then come next year, you could, you know, buy it from us, all this stuff. The husband comes home a little later, and he's shown me all this work because he's a contractor. So all this work he's done on other houses, and we're like, you know, we're thinking, like, maybe we could do the rent to own, right? Purchase it for a low price, and then this guy can come in, and so they would get the business and the sale of their house, because the impression they gave us was that they would not be around, like they were too busy to really flip the house or renovate the house or whatnot, so they just wanted to maybe get rid of it now. Okay, so he's showing us all this stuff. He's showing us this cool heating system. He had this heating system, by the way, which blew my mind. He, you know, like a wood burning stove, but it was like gigantic. It was like a it looked like a huge furnace, and it was like maybe 100 yards from the house, 50 yards from the house, and it had a big gate on it, like a big door, heavy door, and he would just put wood in it and burn it. And he was able, that heat would transfer into these pipes under the house and heat the house. And he would close it. And he said he was burning wood since October. And he would just throw like a log on a day and heat the house. He said that his heating bill last year was $300.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I have never seen, I've seen wood burning stoves. And I know a couple of people who have wood burning stoves, like down by my my parents. There's a neighbor who has a wood-burning stove. He's chopping wood all the time, put wood in. But this was something completely – it was like a wood-burning – it looked like a what's the thing where you burn bodies? Like a crematorium. That's what it looked like. Like it looked like maybe he had gotten it from a crematorium. Maybe that's it. Maybe he showed us too much, and he uses bodies to heat his house.
That's a really long piece of wood. Was that about 6 feet, 4 inches or so? It's weird. When you put the wood in, you hear knocking and screaming from inside.
Yeah. Are those teeth? No. Ashes.
So you were from old school Germany, I understand.
Yeah. So we leave there. We're like, oh, this could be an option. And maybe, you know, maybe this is what we should do. Flash forward to Tuesday. So that was Friday. Flash forward to Tuesday of last week. And today is Tuesday. So only a week ago. So Tuesday, 4 days after they had us over, they go, hey, we're just going to, they text Alex, we're going to put the house on the market to see what offers we can get. And you guys would have first option. Don't worry. You don't have to go anywhere. We're not rushing you, blah, blah, blah. No rush. We just want to see, blah, 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 what offers we get. Now, right away, I'm like, one, you don't, that's not how this works. Like, you don't see what other people are offering you and then say, hey, that's what you have to pay. No. If I want to offer you something for a property, I'm offering it. Not other people are going to decide.
Anytime somebody weirdly text you something, and then the caveat at the end is, oh, don't worry, that's when you start panicking.
Yeah.
Because that's usually them saying, don't worry, because if you do, you might find out what we're about to do.
Yeah. So I'm suspect right away. Alex texts me, like, you know, sad face emoji and the text message. And right away, I knew, like, this, we're going to have to shut this down because, Now, the price they're listing this house at is crazy, okay? Mike, you've been in this place dozens and dozens and dozens of times. They're listing this place for $299,000.
Okay, just to give a little preface to that number you gave, I currently, me and Izzy are shopping for houses down here in Georgia.
Yep.
We put a bid on a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house for $149,000.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And let me preface.
We are overpaying.
Let me preface what Mike just said with what I'm living in. I am living in a 1-bathroom, 0-bedroom house. That's correct. A 0-bedroom, basically a studio. It's a little lake cottage.
Studio.
And it's a little lake cottage, which is kind of cool. So that just shows you and they paid $210 for it 2 years ago. So they're throwing it up for $90,000 more than they paid for it 2 years ago. And what's crazy is the market is so crazy in this community, in this area, that we're talking to the real estate agent that they might have an offer already close to that, which is insane to me. Insane.
Yeah, when it comes to the housing market, when it's hot, it's hot. Like when we first went out, like when she said, well, let's look around or whatever, I'm like, all right, this is going to be a multi-month process and everything to go through. Meanwhile, the day we saw it, we had to basically bid and then change our bid within one day just to be considered.
Yeah, they say the market is very good right now. It's a buyer's market.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I know people are tuning in like, are we listening to the HGTV podcast?
Ah, but if it gets us numbers, sure, why not?
But I think that's all over because I think, you know, there's a lot of people now shopping for houses. So but Georgia, it just shows you, you know, the difference of what you get, you know, from Northeast to there. But I imagine a lot of people are moving because I know a lot of people are moving to North Carolina. I know that's a huge state. So I'm sure it's pushing a little bit more south, a little bit more south, a little bit more south, and Georgia will start to sell.
It's cost of living. That's the bottom line. I mean, that's why when I eventually chose to start looking for jobs and all, I pretty much said, I'm looking out in New Jersey unless I get the best offer. And it's the cost of living in New Jersey is just flat out embarrassing. Like every time we tell people this is what you get for this price, they just look at you with a glare like, how on earth can you live? And
yeah.
I mean, if I get my house, I'm going to pay less than my apartment in New Jersey.
Yep. So we decided we got to get the hell out of here. Like, I'm not going to pay that for this place, one. And two, it's obvious that we're being pushed out, like, slowly. You know, not even slowly. So we're scrambling. We're thinking about, oh, God, we're going to have to move back to my parents again. And listen, moving back to parents, everyone does a stint. You know, it seems like everyone does a stint. You got to go for a couple months.
I'm doing mine.
Exactly. You're doing your time now. And, but I just came from there 2 years ago. So I'm not, I am not ready to go back. And my parents are wonderful. Don't get it wrong. Like, they never complained a day that I was there, you know, like, fine. But, you know, when you're a grown man, you want your space, even if it's a little space. Like, you just want your life, you know. You don't want to be like, okay, I'm back at mom and dad's, you know. And thankfully, I messaged somebody, a guy I play volleyball with in the community. He's got a couple rental properties. He's been here for long. He knows everyone. He's like the mayor of Denville. And
the mayor of the rentals.
Yeah.
That's the first show on our HGTV podcast.
Yeah. And so I'm like, I just like, ah, what the hell? And I message him like, dude, do you know anybody renting anything or something? Now, our goal was to get one more year and then buy something next year after the wedding, you know, after we pay all this crazy stuff, have the wedding, and just, you know, be a little bit more settled. And lucky enough, he said, I'll see what you can do. And then a day later, his wife owns our next door neighbor's place. And well, they own the next, and she was working out there, and she comes and knocks on the door. She's like, oh yeah, we'll keep our eye out. We were talking to her, and she's like, yeah, my friend had a place, but I think they got renters. And then like an hour later, she comes knocking on the door, and she's like, the renters they had, it fell through. So we went over there that day. It's like where I live, it's like around the lake on the other side, about a mile away. And it's a little bit more expensive, but it's worth it because we're going to keep like our lifestyle and our community and our commutes and, you know, all that stuff. So we did find a place, but I think we need to be basically out of here and in there by Tuesday.
Well, it's very simple. You just take everything, throw it in the lake, and hopefully the current goes in the direction where your house is.
Sit outside with, like, leaves and see which way they're blowing and be like, oh, it's blowing towards the house.
It's now time. Go, 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 go. It's 2:30 on a Monday. I don't care. The currents are in.
So that's what I've been dealing with, bro. Plus, I've been working like a couple side jobs, video gigs, a couple comedy things, trivia. So I don't usually get stressed, but this is the first like 2 days that I feel like up to here and crap, you know, like all right, I got to figure out where to sort it out. Like usually Alex is the stress ball of the two of us, and I'm like the more like things will work out, things will be okay. And I know they will, but okay, it's, you know, it's been a little crazy. So that's why I'm like a little wired today.
Yeah. Well, you don't look it. You look as spectacular as ever.
Thanks, pal. That's why you're here. That's why you're here. But
that's the only reason. You said, Berlew, compliment me or you're off the show.
Yeah. And you haven't complimented me since, so I don't know what I'm waiting for.
That's a very good organized closet behind you.
It's actually not that good. There's a lot of clothes that fell down. There's a lot.
No. In my opinion, it's wonderful, and that's all you need to know. You're special,
Mike. I think it is officially guest time.
Yeah, I was getting sick of those rumors about guest time. You know, I was hearing on the internet, but I'm so glad we got confirmation now.
Those unofficial guest times.
Yeah. You know, you go on the Verbal Shenanigans Reddit page and some dude's like, yo, guest time at 6:12 a.m. next Thursday. I swear.
It's guest time.
I heard from a source.
But I'm excited about this interview. He is he went to the same college as me. He went to Ramapo. Not many famous people or well-known people came out of Ramapo College of New Jersey. So he's like our crown jewel here. But you can catch him on ESPN Radio. ESPN Radio every day with Michael Kay. He is hilarious on the show. He's known for his outbursts and a little bit of his rage sometimes. The one and only Don LaGreca.
Nice.
Yeah. So, kind of put this together last minute, which is pretty awesome. And you know, you can catch him he calls games for the Jets. He does some Rangers hockey occasionally. He does a lot, basically everything New York sports. And I believe he's still a resident of New Jersey. So let's give Don LaGreca a call.
Hello.
Hey, Don. It's Scott.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
LaGreca, thank you. Thanks so much for giving us a few minutes here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Don, I was just saying, we have something in common. We are both road runners, which is...
Oh, you went to Ramapo. Excellent.
Yeah, right, which is not like usually the mascot that you brag about. You don't, you know, it doesn't sound very fierce, but...
No.
But, you know, we got to hold on to each other because we don't have a lot of Ramapo fame coming out of Ramapo, so... you know, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Now, Don, I wanted to really start at the beginning here with where did you, I know you started in broadcasting at Ramapo and whatnot, but were you always, was radio the thing you always wanted to get into? Was it a play-by-play? Did you think you were going to do talk radio? What was your initial, like, thought?
Well, I was always fascinated by radio, but most of my childhood, I thought I was going to be a professional baseball player.
Wow.
I was a pitcher, and I was pretty good. You know, and as a kid, you have dreams, and the feeling was that maybe I would do something in sports, and I'd play, and, you know, I was good, and I was a varsity pitcher my freshman year at Don Bosco Tech, and so I was always pretty good and always felt like that this might be a career that I carve out for myself. And then when I was going to college, I wanted to play baseball in college. Ramapo had won the Division III World Series in 84.
Yep.
And even though there were no scholarships or anything, they kind of recruited me about, you know, let's come to Ramapo. We got a good baseball program. And my senior year, I had won the communications award. We had electives our senior year, and I took communications and I won an award. So I kind of filed that away as, you know, I'll be a communications major when I go to college, which I was, and tried out for the baseball team. And then Army had actually had three transfers that were pitchers, and they came in and I got cut. So I went right to the radio station. I did some sports at the station. I did a heavy metal radio show and just completely fell in love and immersed myself in radio. as what I wanted to do for a living, and fortunately I was able to do that. But you know, had my baseball career been a little bit better, if I had made the team, maybe it would have delayed the inevitable. Maybe it would have sent me in a different direction. Who knows? But I guess getting cut from the baseball team ended up being the best thing that can happen to me.
Now, were you doing sports radio in college, or did that find you later?
Well, I mean, I first went into it to do sports. The first things I did at Ramapo were, you know, some play-by-play, some baseball and basketball, and I did a sports talk show. So this is right around the time, my freshman year was September of 86. So by July of 87, that summer, was when The Fan came on, so sports radio became like a thing.
Yep.
So I was doing sports radio, and I had listened to sports radio before The Fan. I used to listen to Art Rush Jr. I used to be on WABC, so I knew of sports radio, but then it kind of became a thing where that could be a destination for me. And then I got the music bug, and that's where it really kind of came together. And so it became, I probably did more music at college radio than I did sports by the time I graduated.
When you were doing radio, can you look back at some of your stuff? Like, did you go in there with, like, some people try to get, like, a catchphrase going when they started radio? Or were you more calm or more excitable? How did you feel about your early days?
Well, the thing is, there weren't a lot of people doing it. Like I said, Art Rush Jr., in the beginning, if you remember, The Fan in 87 had, like, Jim Lampley and had Stan Martin. There was a lot, you know, so you kind of were yourself, you know, and you kind of just did whatever you did, and you tried to want to be yourself. I experimented with long pauses. I thought sometimes that would be kind of meaningful to put words separated like that for emphasis, you know.
You know, I keep telling Mike to do longer
radio,
pauses.
Right? But that was college radio. You had a handful of listeners, if any, and it allowed you to kind of experiment for whatever was how you were able to do it, you know. So if I played you stuff from back then, it might be even unrecognizable to me because I was like toying with different things. And then you realize you're at your best when you just let your guard down and you're yourself. So no fake voices, no and no shtick. It was all just do whatever you do.
Yeah, it's like it's fascinating to me. I do comedy, but I also listen to a lot of like comedians' podcasts and radio shows, and I love when they play. You know, when they have the balls to play their early stuff, and it just sounds like they're putting on a voice or some bad character, and they, you know, they could barely listen to it themselves.
Yeah, it's uncomfortable. Yeah. And you want to fail. You don't want to fail being something else. You want to fail and at least look in the mirror and say, I did it my way kind of deal. And so that's ultimately what ends up being the best thing for you, how you're the most comfortable. It's hard enough to do radio, never mind trying to do it like somebody else.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you about sports phone, because that seems like something that, you know, when I was just like looking over your career and whatnot, I almost completely forgot about sports phone. Can you explain what that was?
Well, sports phone was the way you got scores back in the day, before ESPN's Bottom Line, before computers and beepers. It was a 1 minute message. You called 976-1313, and every 10 minutes we would update the scores. And there's a thing called a television machine, which is a big glorified kind of answering machine that, you know, you would dial a number, you would record the message, and then every 10 minutes you'd change it. And it really helped your inflection, and you did, you know, you, I don't know how many, you do the math. If you worked an 8-hour shift doing updates every 10 minutes, you did, you know, plenty of sports reports, and that's where I was able to get my inflection and my pacing down. And it was a way that you were able to get scores. If you were out with your friends in the late 80s, early 90s, you wanted to know the Yankee score, and you were at a place where you didn't have television or radio, you went to the pay phone, you called 976-1313, you got the score.
I'm sure you never had any degenerate gamblers calling in that line.
Well, that was what it was about. Well, that's what it was about. I mean, we did the scores that were on the Vegas line, in the order in which the Vegas line had it. No, sure, it was. I mean, most people were probably betting on it. But there was also people that were just fans who wanted to know the score. And this is before cell phones. This is, again, before the Bottom Line on ESPN. I mean, where else were you going to get the score? And I became a popular person you know, because I was in my early 20s, we'd go out with some friends and, hey, what's the score? And I said, all right, well, I knew the backdoor numbers, the 800 number, and I'd call, go to the payphone and be able to give everybody the score
right
that they wanted. Mm-hmm. And again, for you guys or for anybody listening that's under the age of 30, it sounds ridiculous that it was so prehistoric the way you got your information, but that's the way it was.
Yeah, so, I remember in my day was turning on headline news and hoping to get them right at the 20 or the 50 mark when they did sports. And
right.
Even then, they were about a half an hour behind.
Right, and then you watch the bottom line on ESPN, and just as they got to your score, they'd go to commercial, and then they come back from commercial, and they already moved on, and you're sitting there for 45 minutes waiting for a score. Absolutely. It was, you know, but pre-internet and pre-phone, and it was, this was the way it was done.
So now, Don, you have gotten into, it seems like you have touched on basically all the local sports teams and whatnot, but when did you seem to go from college radio, sports phone, to being really into kind of the world of New York sports radio? What was your first, or New York sports in general, what was your first exposure to that?
Well, it would be sports phone, because we did cover games. Because I was the guy from Jersey, so I covered a lot of Devil and Net games. And
yep.
There were sometimes I'd cover some of the baseball, Mets and Yankees or Jets and Giants. So, you know, it wasn't a radio station. It was you covered things like it was. So you went to press conferences. You went to games. I mean, some pretty significant people came from sports phone. Bob Papa, Al Troutwick, Howie Rose, Michael Kay. There's a lot of people that came from there. So that's where I really got exposed to the sports scene, immersed myself really in the sports scene from there. So when my first gig in radio was 1010 Wins doing sports updates, and then in 96 I went to The Fan. But I already had a resume of covering sports that dated back to the dealing with it at sports phone.
Can you recall who the first big sports figure that you talk to, and were you in awe, or were you able to keep it as professional as possible?
I it's hard to explain. Like, I never really was in awe. I mean, I always worshiped Lawrence Taylor when I was younger, when I first met him, the early days of ESPN. Just it was crazy because I was doing an update on the Michael Kay show, and he was just staring at me because he didn't know where to put his eyes. And I got Lawrence Taylor staring me down, and I'm doing the update. But, you know, you knew that you had to be professional, and you knew that being a fan was not the thing to do. You know, so I covered some of those really good Devil teams in the early 90s with, you know, John McClain and Claude Lemieux.
My favorite player ever, John McClain.
I remember... it was me and Steve Goldstein, who's the play-by-play voice of the Panthers. I just thought about him being involved in his story, and I've seen him a bunch of times, and I never reminisced with him about it. I think he was working for might have moved on from Sports Phone, and I was working for Sports Phone at the time. And we were waiting for Lemieux. He had scored like a big goal, and the Devils had their locker room, and then there was a little room. It was kind of had some couches in it, and then that room led to the showers. And you weren't allowed in that room, but Lemieux wasn't coming out, and we were waiting for him. And the PR director at the time said, you know, if you want to talk to Claude, he's here. So you go in. So we went in, and Claude Lemieux was completely naked, just like stretched out on the couch, like with his legs wide open. And almost as if like to intimidate us not to talk to him, but we had our job to do, so we sat there and we interviewed him. So I mean, that was kind of a, you know, crazy moment, because I always respected Lemieux and a great player, and growing up a Devil fan, it was like great to talk to him. But I think I just kind of knew it was kind of known at the time that being fanboy was like the worst thing you can do. There was like, you know, urban legends and stories of people that allowed their fandom to get in the way of their job. So by the time I got a chance to do it, I knew I didn't want to be that guy. So I was able to kind of separate myself from, oh my God, I'm interviewing Brett Hull or Wayne Gretzky, to just, hey, listen, I got a job to do. I want to do it as well as I can.
Yeah. I find that interesting about you. Like, you know, listening to you on the K-Show, you know, I know you were a Met fan, and yet you work with the Yankee announcer. You're a Devil fan, but you get to do the Ranger games. Are you a Giant fan, too? I can't remember.
Yes, Giant fan, yes.
So you were basically doing all the opposite teams, but, you know, like you said, I guess it's like that's the number one thing about being professional is not letting your, you know, your fandom get in there. But, you know, it is funny how that worked out for you.
You got to turn it off. And I, probably the best thing for me, because as passionate as I was as a sports fan, if that passion and that fandom kind of leaks into the job you're trying to do, then you're not going to be able to give unbiased reporting. And it's hard. You have to shut it off. I'm not saying it's easy.
Yep.
It's very, very difficult. And, you know, and over time, you know, it kind of weighs away your ability to stay a diehard fan, because you've got to put your career first.
Yep.
Obviously. But I really do think that it made me better at my job, that I wasn't necessarily a fan of those teams, and it became more of a job, and it allowed me to be unbiased and do the job that I need to do.
That being said, how great is it to see the Devils back where they belong in the playoffs? It's a pretty awesome feeling. This was an amazing season to watch.
Oh, good. Listen, you know, I grew up a Devil fan, and working with the Rangers for the last 10 years, the fandom certainly went away to a certain extent. But listen, it's still in your soul, the team that you grew up rooting for. And being a hockey fan where hockey doesn't get talked about very much,
yep.
I want all three teams to do well, because if they're in the playoffs, there's a better chance we'll talk about it. So,
yep.
But what was eerie about it, and I was talking about with this with somebody the other day, is that, you know, this is the first post-Lou run that they've ever had. You know, so this is no Brodeur, no... Because I go back to 88 with Sean Burke going to the conference final even before Marty. But to do it with, they hadn't done a thing since, you know, without Lou. They didn't do a thing before Lou came in 87 and hadn't done anything since he left. So it was just interesting to see them start to grow away from that. And ironically, to see them clinch the playoff berth against the Leafs and Lou's team. And I think they've got a really, really good future. And I think that was a great experience, even though it was only five games and certainly ended in disappointing fashion. Those are five games that Hall and Butcher and Heeshear had never played in before. And that's going to make them that much better at what they do down the road.
Yeah, I mean, Heeshear, Hall, Kincaid and Butcher and Vatanen. I think those guys were the key to success this year.
Well, we'll see, because I do think the door opened up that Schneider can get his job back here. And
I do too.
They invested a lot in him, and he's making a lot of money. So I think they want him to be the goalie. And I think if there's anything positive that came from it, was that he did get the job back and he did win a game and did keep him in the game. So as you know, Kincaid was a great story, but I still think they're probably better off that Schneider won that job back, and now they know they have a go-to guy in case Schneider falls.
Yeah, me too. I just meant like Kincaid. Down the stretch, those were the MVPs, that group of five.
Kincaid was a tremendous story. There's no question. He and Hall were the whole reasons they got in there, for sure.
Yeah. Well, if you guys got a spare goalie, being a Flyers fan, we've been looking for one since 87, so if you could hook a team up, that'd be great.
It sounds like this Hart kid's legit, and he's a couple of years away, and Hextall's going to be very patient being a former goaltender. So if he turns out to be legit, maybe if you can just hang on for a year or two, that maybe you will have, you know, the next franchise goaltender, which you've been waiting 30 years for.
Yeah. It's been painful. But going back to a point you were saying earlier about hockey, I kind of find it fascinating. We've been lucky enough to talk to a few other hockey greats, Dave Anderchuk, Jim Poplinski, and we talked about how hockey has been, ever since it left ESPN, it has really struggled to get that mass of fans back. I'm just wondering your thoughts, being a big fan, what do you see it bringing it back? Can it be something special like what's happening in Las Vegas right now, or do you see any route they can take to get it back to a legitimate top four sport?
Well, I think it's getting there. I mean, I think the ESPN thing only looks bad because it's the one sport that ESPN doesn't do. But when you look at how NBC has really pushed to have every one of these playoff games on, and I think they've done a good job. But the fact that you might have a Western Conference final of Nashville versus Vegas, that people are actually having legitimate conversations about how, boy, can they match the energy in the building in Nashville and Vegas? I mean, think about that. 10 years ago. Not Montreal, it's not Toronto, it's not Boston, it's not New York. They're talking about Vegas and Nashville. as like the quintessential playoff atmospheres. That helps the sport for sure. And have these non-traditional hockey markets excel, that's big. I mean, they did it. They did great regional ratings for their first year. The success that they've had kind of made them a national following and a big story. So I think Nashville and Vegas are their best chances here. You're not relying on the original six teams and the big market teams all the time, that these non-traditional hockey markets can work and thrive.
Yeah, I remember when the Devils were rumored to go to Nashville after
they
won
their cup. I was
devastated.
That was pretty scary, man.
Yeah. So I want to ask you, so I know you had you have twins and whatnot, so congratulations on that. And I wanted to ask you, so your life is so immersed in sports and sports talk and being on top of the game. Do you ever get a chance to decompress and get away from sports for a little bit? Or is that you feel that you're just obligated to always know what's going on?
Well, it's not an obligation. I think it's fun to do.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was pumping gas or a plumber or a police officer or a fireman, I'd be probably watching as much sports as I do now. I mean, this is what I do. This is what I love.
Mm-hmm.
So my decompression is sitting there the other day and watching the two hockey games or watching the Mets or, you know, watching whatever's going on in sports at that time. I mean, it's important, you know, to me. So I never looked at it as work. I never looked at it as preparation. So, you know, and the twins obviously have me thinking about things other than sports for sure. But to get them into it, to make sports a part, I can't wait till they get older where they can appreciate the things that I'm doing and seeing. That's a part of my life. It's a part of who I am.
Now, you have to feel blessed to be on a very successful radio show every day and whatnot. And one of the funniest parts, you know, that is entertaining for the listeners is, you know, hearing clips of your classic meltdowns and whatnot, you know, because it's hilarious. But do you ever get, you know, do you ever let the listeners really get under your skin, or are you able to let that pass right after that moment happens?
No, those are all genuine because they do get under my skin, you know, because I they drive me crazy and I let them drive me crazy, but it makes for good radio. But it's never fabricated. It usually stems from them just annoying me to the point where I can't take it anymore. But no, I learned to let it go. But no, they're not fabricated. They're all true. And the fans really know what buttons to push on me. There's no question about it. But I got to run, guys. I apologize.
Yeah, no problem.
My wife's waiting for me home. I want to give you more time. If you want to continue it another day, I'd love to do it because it's been fun.
Hey, no problem. Well, maybe we'll schedule.
I don't want to get on her bad side.
Yeah. I don't blame you. Maybe we can schedule something in the future or whatnot. But thanks for giving us the time that you did. And good luck you with everything you got going on.
This is my pleasure, man. This is a lot of fun. Good luck.
All right, Don McGreca.
Yeah, I guess when you're so into sports and going to all the games that are all the time, it's hard to tell the wife. No, seriously, I got a podcast to do.
Yeah, I got to do. I got to do more. I got to do more radio with Scott and Mike. Duh.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's pretty awesome.
I was hoping to ask him how much he put into the welcome back Mike Francesca cake.
Yeah, is that official? Is he coming back, or was that, I saw that news story pop up a bunch of times.
It's, for what I understand, it's basically official, just a matter of the schematics of what they're doing. And you know, it's kind of scummy and all, cuz from what I understand, it's a lot like the whole Jay Leno thing where he went away and then he wanted back, and they're like, oh, we'll put Jay on an hour before the Tonight Show. It's something equivalent to that, where they're saying he's going to do like 1 to 3 and then give the current crew the rest of the time. And it's just like, everybody's saying the same thing. It's like he basically retired, said, all right, I could do whatever I want. I'm going to get so many deals. Didn't get them, got bored, basically forced his way back in, and now he's picking people up. For what I understand, like he did like a small thing with his old
Mad Dog
colleague.
Yep.
Mad Dog, and one of them said the joke, I wonder who they're going to fire with you going back. Ha, ha, ha. And it's like rubbing a lot of people the wrong way.
Yeah, I didn't get really to read deep into it, but If they put him on before that afternoon show's doomed because all his fans are just going to call in and be like, where's Mike? You know, why are you guys on? You know, like they can't, if they really believe in that show, they can't like try to have him compete, you know, like with that show because it's not going to work.
Yeah, and I feel bad for the one guy on that show, Chris Carlin, because I remember listening to him on 94.1 in Philadelphia, and they basically went to him directly requested him to take the spot in New York where he had to move away. And now you basically, all right, you took me off of Philly, which he was doing good in the afternoon, and now you're basically saying, all right, we're going to playing around with your career after we moved you.
Yeah, he's moved around a lot, though. He's done a lot of different... He did the pregame for the Mets back in the day. He did a show on SNY. Like, yeah, he's been all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's part of the deal, but still, it's like when they hand you that, you got to figure at least a couple years, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So that was cool to get to talk to Don for a few minutes, and maybe we could schedule him again in the future. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, we'll just schedule him every time he goes home.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you in traffic? We want to talk to you about a few things. I want to talk Jets.
Yeah. But that was pretty awesome. So let's take a break. All right. It is time to get to another guest here. And this one's pretty cool. His resume speaks for itself as far as the music industry. He has worked on numerous things. I mean, if you go... And you Wikipedia John Fryer, he's an English record producer, and just look at some of the projects he's worked on, everything from Depeche Mode to Nine Inch Nails to just name it. It goes on and on and on. The guy has been involved with a lot of things, so it should be really fun to talk to. And he's also been involved with a lot of soundtracks, and he's got a new project, Black Needle Noise, coming out. So. Let's give John Fryer a call.
Hello.
John Fryer, it's Scott from Verbal Shenanigans. How are you, buddy?
Scott, how you doing? Long time no see.
I know. It's almost like we forgot what each other looks like.
Well, we have.
John, thanks for giving us a few minutes on the show here. Where am I calling you from? You got a California area code?
I am in California, indeed. I am in my studio in Van Nuys at the moment.
Lucky you. I am in cloudy, cold New Jersey right now. It just doesn't seem to ever want to get warm again. So I would take your situation first.
Well, thank you most kindly, sir.
So, John, I was just saying before I called you.
Are we live on air?
Oh, we are. Well, we're recording, so, you know, it doesn't really matter.
It's being recorded or is it live?
Recording. And then we'll probably put it up on Friday.
Okay. So I was just worried about swearing and stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah, you can do whatever you want. It's a podcast, okay. So you can curse, you can do whatever. You can tell me embarrassing stories.
Well, I can't do that.
So I was saying before, right before I called you, You're kind of a hard guy to start with because your career now has spanned quite a long time and you've been involved in so many different things in the music industry. It's kind of hard to, pick one thing or two things to talk about. So I guess what I wanted to ask you first was, were you as a young guy, were you a musician? Were you in bands yourself or how did really producing find you?
It kind of found me as a happy accident, I guess you would say. No, it's like I enjoyed music and I was, a frustrated guitar player. I'm still a frustrated guitar player. But I just can't get my hands around changing the chords.
Well, you know, moving your fingers.
So I kind of play open tune like the old blues guys used to.
There you go.
So it makes life easier for me. So I used to help friends with bands and do, you know, help with live sound. And then they went into a studio and the guy, Eric, who was running the studio, needed someone to help him. And it just so happened that I had been made unemployed very recently. So he's like, okay, I need a job. You need someone to help you. So I started there there and then, and kind of left 10 years later.
Now, like, obviously going from, you know, playing music to producing music is a whole different thing. Now, when you were you like more of like a guitar tech, or were you setting things up, or were you like all hands on everything?
No, always from the beginning, it was all hands on, and you know, you kind of fly by the seat of your pants and learn as you go along.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you: so when you think of a producer, you know, you hear so many different kinds. Now, would you find yourself more of this kind of hands off, let the band or artist you're working with come in with a bunch of stuff and then you help fine tune it, or do you learn how, or is every case completely different?
It's kind of, everything's completely different, you know? So you can't, because of it's so many different kinds of music I've worked on, you can't really have the same approach to every band.
Right.
So, you know, some bands are electronic, some bands are live, some bands are a mixture. So you have to adapt. Someone called me a chameleon once, to adapting to all the different styles of music.
So like, if a band like you've worked with Depeche Mode, like they come in, what are they like? Are they coming in? Are they wanting your opinions on everything? Do you let them lay down tracks and then you kind of figure it out? Give us a little insight to like the everyday workings of working with a band like that.
Yeah, I mean, they would come in, they would more or less come in with a song kind of written, and then it's more finding the sounds and then enhancing parts and then maybe adding new parts.
So
the basic, the broad, coming in with the basics would already be there, I would say.
So what is your preferred approach? Are you, you know, at this point, do you have, you know, a way that you work now as opposed to when you were younger? In you know, it says you here producing since what, 1980? I'm sure you've definitely changed in four decades here.
Yeah, I don't have as much patience as I used to.
Well, let's talk about that. How does that work? So does a band come in like on a budget with X amount of studio time, or do you block this out weeks ahead of time? This is the cutoff date. This is when things need to be done. You know?
No, I mean, when I was working at Blackwing, it was always, you know, people used to say to me, how long does it take to make a record? And it's like, well, you know, like, how long is a piece of string? Or really, it's how big is the budget? Right. Is how long you get to make a record. So if they're on a very limited budget, you're on a very limited time. So then, you know, it's not like a job you can have working in an office where it's, okay, let's put off till tomorrow or finish it tomorrow. You're limited. If you've got one day in the studio, you've got one day in the studio, because normally the studio is booked the day after.
Yeah, right, right.
With someone else. So then you have to make sure whatever you're doing is finished, whether you work, you know, for 8 hours, 12 hours, or 24 hours to get it done.
Mm-hmm. So when did you... So are you still a fan of the old analog systems, or are you completely digital at this point? Because I know you do a lot of electronic stuff and synths, but as far as recording, do you still keep the analog things alive or no?
At the moment, I mean, I have done. I was in Copenhagen recording. But it normally works out, see, because of budgets, to do it all through analog equipment, but on, you know, onto Pro Tools or something.
Right.
It's much cheaper to buy a hard drive than it is to buy tape.
Yeah.
Plus, you're very limited to tape, whether you're running at 30 inch or 15 inch, how much time you can get on there.
So, I mean, I look, like I said, you got 4AD and Mute and Rough Trade and Nine Inch Nails and all these things. Who's the most organized band you've seen that came in that with their, you know, their album blueprint that they wanted from start to finish, and it was you know, very precise and it came out exactly the way they want? Who came in well prepared?
Lots of bands have come in. That's kind of a weird question, because I mean, I've worked with some bands where they've demo the songs, written their songs, and they come in the studio, and basically everything is written in stone. You can't change anything.
Right.
You can't change a sound. You can't change performances. That's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. And then other bands have come in with, you know, just kind of a sketch, and then you flush it out in the studio.
Right.
And, you know, it's, and again, it's sort of say it's very, you know, some bands come in like that with still on a very limited budget, but you still have to flush out the song. Other bands come in, you know, with a big budget and they have everything written. I don't know. It's just like it's a bit of everything.
Anybody ever come in with absolutely nothing?
almost, yes. I mean, when I was working with Love and Rockets, it was basically let's write the album in the studio.
Yeah. Yeah, that's got to be. Is that stressful as a producer, or is that more work for the band?
It can be less stressful because there's nothing, you know, there's no parameters set. You just go off and do what you're going to do.
Right. All right. Now, I wanted to ask you. You have you have producer credits on Pretty Hate Machine, which is an album that is still, you know, revered all over and. Some people think it's Nine Inch Nails' best. What were they like to work with?
Well, it wasn't a they, it was a him.
Well, yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, back then, I mean, other people have taken credit for whatever they've taken credit for. But when I worked with him in the studio, it was just him and I. It was just the two of us.
What was that like?
It was... an interesting time. That's all I'm going to say.
An interesting time. Well, it came out good.
Yeah. I mean, it was another one of them situations where we didn't. I think we were recording 10 songs in 20 days. You know, it wasn't the great big budget on his first album.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you don't have great deals of time to experiment. You know, there was experimentation, but you know, basically what you really have to do is get everything down as fast as can and then try and experiment a bit afterwards, or you know, you try a little bit along the way, but it's you know, there's not much time. 2 days per song is not a lot.
So as you get more successful as a producer, and you start to have, you know, obviously build a resume for yourself. Do you find you have a lot? Do you find a lot more people seeking you out, or do you still have to kind of go out and try to find artists to work with? Or do you really now have the ability to kind of really pick and choose your projects?
It's still people coming to me from, you know, all the work that I've done, the body of work. They still come to me because they like, you know, the approach or the sound that I get.
So, like, if so, people, you know, never heard anything, any of your work, what would be like a fingerprint or a thumbprint that, you know, hey, that's a John Fryer record or a John Fryer song? Is there any one thing that, you know, would be a characteristic that people know you as?
I think if you listen to my new project, Black Needle Noise,
yep,
you will hear... I mean, you will kind of hear everything in there from... It's kind of a bit of everything that I've ever worked on.
Right. So, yeah, tell us about Black Needle Noise. I mean, I know Ray had told me that is the new project you're working on, and I read up and listened to one of the singles and whatnot. So what is Black Needle Noise?
It came about because I had two other bands, Dark Drive Clinic and Silver Ghost Shimmer, and for their own personal reasons, after we had made one album each and did a small world tour of California in a blink of an eye, they both decided that they didn't want to continue. And while I was writing music for those projects, because if you've got a band project, you kind of have to have a formulaic sound that fits that style of band, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I had written all this other music and I had it sitting around, and you know, I thought to myself, well, this is really too good just to be sitting there doing nothing. So I decided, you know, because you have to put a lot of effort into creating a band and put, you know, publicizing and And so I just decided that I would stop doing the band thing and then just do a music project where there isn't really any rules. Mm-hmm. I can do whatever I want with it, you know, work with whoever I want, get, you know, make it sound like whatever I want.
Right. Now when you do something like that, that, you know, has, you know, loose control, has, you know, all sorts of synths and different sounds, and people, you know, get into the album and whatnot, and it comes time to turn that into a live show. Do you find that really difficult to do, or is you have no problem with that being, you know, you've been in the industry for so long?
Well, I would approach it how I approach the other two bands doing live, is I would do it more of an organic thing with a live drummer and me playing guitar, another guitarist, and a vocalist or vocalists, and a lot of it on backing.
Right, right.
But it would be too hard to try and replicate everything live, you know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I always wonder about that. Bands who are, you know, go full electronic albums and whatnot, how difficult it is to really start putting together your live sound.
Well, I don't know what other people do, but, you know, I don't try to fake what I'm doing. You know, it's obviously there's stuff I'm backing, and it's just, you know, I prefer it with the live guitars and live drums because it's, I think it's more. So it's more organic live, and it gives it a different feel.
Definitely. Now, I wanted to ask you, so you've seen the music industry, you know, go through all different things from tape to CD to record to digital. As a producer, how is your life different now that, or is it different, you know, now that with everything being streamed and everything being shared and, you know, a lot of bands and artists really making a bulk of their money touring and playing out, does that affect, you know, bands coming in to make records? Is it on a, you know, is there not the budget there used to be? Do you find a hard time with people buying full albums anymore instead of just like streaming singles and whatnot? What is your take on that?
Well, yes to everything you just said. yes, I mean, there's no real labels anymore, so there's no, you know, there's, it's hard for bands to get funding. So either they're doing crowdfunding or pledges, or they're paying for it themselves.
Right.
But like even with me doing my own projects, it's, you know, you're kind of an unknown entity, so it's very hard. And then playing live is hard again because who's going to come and see you?
Yeah.
You know, especially if you're really unknown starting out, you know, you got to start back at the bottom again.
Yeah, I mean,
and even though you may, it's like I was doing a lecture and they were saying, well, you know, you have all your fans on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But I was saying you could have a million fans on Facebook, but then only 10 of them might be in the city you're going to play, and then 5 of them have other things to do. So you've basically got 5 people in the audience.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we've talked to so many artists on here, you know, of different levels. You know, we've had people who had hit records in the 90s to a lot of artists starting out and whatnot. And it's always this kind of double-edged sword where, yeah, it's this amazing thing for artists to get their music out there, especially unknown artists, because you're directly connecting with your fans and whatnot. But it seems like there's no such thing as selling too many albums anymore. So it is all touring, and, you know, that's a whole lifestyle to itself.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's back in the day when you had the labels, they would give you tour support.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's expensive to go on the road.
Right.
You're feeding back there.
Oh, no, that was actually a stove. An oven going off. So that was just a beep of the oven. The chicken's ready if you want some.
Oh, no, thank you.
No, but yeah, you were saying, tour support.
Yeah, you know, the labels will give you tour support. And now, you know, there's no real labels. So there's no one funding you because, you know, then you'd have to, especially if you're a band starting out, you're probably not going to make any money from the gigs that you play. So then you've got to pay out for the transport, you know, your equipment for sleeping somewhere.
Right.
Eating. and probably, you know, I don't know how long it will take you before, you know, how long it will take before you actually start making money on the road.
Yeah.
You know, if you, you know, even if you had merch, you still got to pay for the merch up front, and sell that live. But, you know, it's still.
So what do you think the solution to that for an artist to make money?
I don't know. For that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that is kind of where we're at right now. They're kind of in this in-between on how, you know, how artists get paid, where, you know, so many, they're able to get their music everywhere, but, you know, actually making a living off it. I can't imagine how you guys do it.
It's very, you know, it's very, very difficult now.
Now, you, do you find that, you know, being doing so many great projects and being around, do you get jaded at all towards new music? Do you what is your feeling on like the state of music? Do you even pay attention to pop music, or, you know, do you still think there's, you know, a lot of great artists out there?
But there's always a mixture, and there's always been a mixture of good artists, great artists, and bad artists. Yep. You know, good music and bad music. There's always been a mixture of that all the way from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's down to personal taste as well, whether you like something or you don't like something.
Right.
You know, I can't tell you what's out there, what you're going to like or what you're not going to like, you know?
Now, before...
Actually, I can. The only thing you're going to like is Black Needle Noise, so
that's
there
it.
You go.
That, for, yeah. That's, you're going to listen to that solo. That's it. Jump everything yeah. else. Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you before we go, you also have a lot of soundtrack work on your resume, from Clerks to Seven to Mortal Kombat to Johnny Mnemonic, and this Resident Evil, was that the video game or was that one of the movies?
To be honest with you, I think it was the movie.
Oh, okay, yeah. But so, what is that different? Are you scoring these? Are you just, or is this music that you've produced being put onto these soundtracks?
No, unfortunately, that's just music that I've produced put on those soundtracks.
Oh. Yeah, I was going to say, being from Jersey, it would be, you know, a sin for me to not ask about Clerks.
You can ask about Clerks?
And, well, it's like the quintessential movie that every Jersey kid kind of grew up on around here. When someone comes to you asking for, like, is it Kevin Smith, the director, asking for songs? Or is it a company saying, hey, we need this type of song. Can you throw us some suggestions?
Well, it's still like that today. They still ask for, you know, we want something sounding like this or something sounding like this, you know, or they might have a reference track that they give you and that you have something sounding like this.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, they can still change their mind at the last minute.
Right. So, John, what do fans have, we know Black Needle Noise, so if fans they hear this and they want to go check it out or get a sample of what's going on, and what projects are you working on now?
I'm actually writing an album for Kiba, who was featured on one of the songs on Black Needle Noise. And several other projects. Mary and the Ram was one of them.
So where can people go check out Black Needle Noise other than
you can go onto Bandcamp and listen to it all there, and you can download it from there and free if you want. You just pay as much as you want on there.
Nice.
Or you can stream it on Spotify, Tidal, Amazon, and, you know, all the normal suspects.
Yeah, I mean, when I got in touch with Ray, he sent me, I checked out a few songs. It's definitely got a cool sound, man. It's definitely very unique and kind of different than what's out there right now. So good luck with it, man.
Well, it's just John Fryer music. It's got the John Fryer sound.
It's true. It's true. John, thanks so much for giving me a few minutes on the show, and good luck with all your projects.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling.
All right, Berlew. So those are our two guests, Don LaGreca, okay, and John Fryer. You weren't there for John Fryer, So two pretty awesome guests, two completely different guests, but awesome nonetheless. So what do you got? I see you're attending KKK rallies.
No, I attended the event before the KKK rally, and that's neo-Nazi, not KKK.
Oh, sorry, different racist, different class of racist. So what was that, man? I saw the the chalk, and obviously I knew that you were there. There was a rally coming in. Is that what it was?
Yeah. So basically, Noonan, Georgia, which is about 15-20 minutes from before 15-20 east, I think, from where I live. But they are basically going through the same thing as what happened in Virginia. There's a Confederate statue outside of a building that they want to take down. So basically some neo-Nazi group got the permits, and they were going to protest at a local park over by where the statue was. So what happened was a bunch of churchgoers decided to have a peace rally the day before. So we actually went down to that, and it was very nice. The park was very crowded. They had an amp system. They were playing some songs. They were giving out chalk to everybody, and they were writing positive messages all over the park. Over some of the statues, the pillars, the
did you receive stairs. Chalk?
I received chalk. All I did was basically do a couple hearts around the place and all, nothing crazy. I was trying to think of an anagram for Noonan, but I couldn't think of anything good, so I just did some hearts.
Why didn't you just selfishly write verbal shenanigans all over the place and hope for some news coverage?
Verbal shenanigans, Christian Picciolini episode. If you want to learn how to get out of hate.
Should've been like love. You should just wrote like love is love. Check out verbal shenanigans. Like just blatantly throw it in there like real hard. Like yeah.
Mm-hmm. Would have been really weird if the Nazis looked at it and be like, "Oh, this is a great show.
We support really these guys."
Like all the people keeping the peaceful stuff, they didn't care about our show. But those Nazis, man, they really shot up the numbers.
These guys would be perfect Nazis. I'm telling you. I'm telling you. Big white Aryan dudes. You know, we like this. We like this. Do you remember when we started really pushing for guests and whatnot that we couldn't get a black guy to come on the show? Like we were pushing, we're gonna get our first black guy on the show. We got him, we got him, and then like one of them canceled, and like something else happened, and like we finally got it. We're like, we're not like a white only show anymore. I think it was Leon Rainbow.
Yeah. Yeah, that was our big discussion. We look at each other like, who did we have that wasn't a white person on this show? We just look at each other like, was Leon Rainbow black? I don't know. Was he Spanish? And we had this in-depth debate on whether we had a black person on the show yet or not.
Well, guys, update. Since then, we've had many, many, many African-American people on the show. So
yeah.
We're
men and women.
We're covering our bases here. We are not racist.
Yeah. But Asians, no.
Yeah, yeah.
Out of the question.
Well, come on. Let's not get crazy.
We're not, we're not that into unity. Come on now.
Listen, almost 200 episodes in, I'm trying to think if there's a demographic we really have not hit.
Eskimo, I guess.
All right.
Native American.
Get on that this week.
I tried. I was trying, like, in all seriousness, I was like any Eskimo kind of tribe that had like a
Wi-Fi.
I'm like, hey, Eskimo tribe.
Oh, update. Last week when I told you I pissed off the rapper, the rapper's PR woman, because I called her a man. Needless to say, we did not get that interview.
Yeah. I see. So we screw up genders here on this podcast.
Yeah. We mess up a lot, but we got a lot of guests on the show. So
yeah, It's big supporters of the Klan, if you recall.
I mean, well, you should probably explain. just tell them that.
No. That was when we were trying to get somebody from the Wu-Tang Clan. I would tweet it out, and this was pre-256 characters. This was the old school days of Twitter, not like you kids got now. But I forget which one of the members it was. But I'm like, hey, big supporter of the Clan. Are you interested?
Yeah,
in the Wu-Tang Clan. Yeah,
and I remember seeing it and being like, Mike, big supporter of the Klan, like to the black guy, you know, like not the best.
Well, he knows what group he was in. It's not like he's like, oh, how dare he? Oh, yeah, I was in that group.
I don't know if he saw like that old picture with you and the Confederate flag or the Duke's thing. And then he saw a big supporter of the Klan. I don't know if
that came very later. That'd be very odd if he changed his mind and then he saw those things. I'd maybe give them a chance. Hey, wait a minute.
But yeah, no, we're not big supporters of the Klan, guys. Not big supporters. Only mildly support. Yeah. No, I'm just joking.
Yeah. There were bad people on both sides. That's all we're saying.
Oh, God. Trump.
We went there. It was a nice little thing. We were there for 40 minutes. We talked to some people. I did bring up, we talked to Christian Picciolini, so I did, you know, promote the cast. But for what I understand, the next day, there was only like 24 Nazis that showed up for the event. It wasn't like the Tiki Torch event of Charlottesville. So that was good. But unfortunately, apparently later on, they went to more southern Georgia and burned some swastikas in the air.
Oh, lovely. Lovely.
So,
well, I just imagine Georgia, like, you're kind of just driving down the highway, like, dodging, like KKK riots. That's what I picture.
Well, I will say, as we drove to Noonan, I noticed on the side there was a sign that said Sons of the Confederacy with the old Duke Boys emblem out there. even when we were looking for homes, there was one. Our first night we were looking at homes, we were going through one neighborhood, and we were still like 10 minutes away, but as we were through the neighborhood, I saw about four or five of them flags going there, and I was kind of looking at Izzy. I'm like, this may not be the best neighborhood for us. I mean, for the friends that come down and see us, we have ethnicity in our friendship, so they may not appreciate, hey, come on down to the Burlew household.
Oh, look, they have a beautiful cross on their front lawn. They've turned to religion.
Yeah.
Burlew's
into the Jesus.
Why is it on fire? Yeah.
Well, we're having a cookout.
Yeah.
Because it's my barbecue.
Yeah, see, like, my vision of the Deep South is like, oh, missed that skinhead. Oof, missed that, you know, like, Klan member, like, you know, just dodging them on the streets.
That sounds like a really weird but awesome video game. Something that came out in the original Nintendo system. Klan dodging.
Dodge the racist.
Oh, man, this is a difficult level. Oh, damn.
There's so many of them.
They're all over the road. I can't get fast enough.
Yeah. So, well, I'm glad you guys kept the Klan out of Noonan.
Yep. Well, we didn't keep them out, but in the end, a very positive thing. And, like, all the pictures that show of them trying to do their rally, everybody's concentrating on all the chalk marks that everybody did out there. So that was nice.
All right. Well, that's good. That's good, at least. Yeah. Oh, man. What else is going on? Anything?
Well, Talladega's this coming weekend. That's a big race. We got our fingers crossed for Trevor Bayne. He's good at the super speedway, so hope for that. I feel kind of bad. There's an announcement coming out. He's going to part-time this year. There's a lot of rumors saying that his MS that he has might be acting up or something like that, where they have to have another person drive the car for a few races this year. So
I didn't even know he had MS.
Yeah.
Wow.
I just found out that, because I was kind of curious about that. I thought it may be sponsorship or he not getting wins or something like that. But the big rumor going around is that's what it is. He does have MS, and
wow.
Some people wonder if he's got to cut back or maybe eventually retire or something like
wow,
that.
Wow, he's young, too. What is he, like 29? Is he 30 yet? I don't know.
I don't think he's 30 yet. I want to say 27, 28.
Oof. Well, and those of you who are wondering why we're talking about this, a couple of years back now, over 2 years ago, we had the opportunity to go out and not only interview him, but ride water slides with him at this opening yep. of this resort by Pocono Raceway. Long story short, so we've always kind of kept tabs on him and see, you know, where he is and whatnot. So, geez, MS. Oof.
Yeah. But the other reason I bring up Talladega is did you know somebody stole the pace car at Talladega 1 year?
No.
Yes. This happened in 1986. In one of NASCAR's most bizarre episodes, Darren Crowder, a Birmingham local, found his way into the ceremonial Pontiac Trans Am before the May 1986 race. The car had apparently been left unattended near the front grandstand. Crowder, at the time age 20, pulled onto the famed oval and started turning laps. The race was minutes from its scheduled starting time. NASCAR only noticed something amiss when Crowder passed an official who correctly identified him as not the pace car driver.
It'd be funny if he was driving and the cops got wind of it and the cops were behind him.
Oh,
but the cars were
Scott.
Hello.
There's more to the story, though.
Oh.
As your observation.
See, I was thinking as like the NASCARs and the police were all following him.
So on the the call on the team radio said, "Who's that fucker in the pace car?" Crowder proceeded to lead police cars and motorcycles on a high-speed chase around the 2.66-mile oval. According to the New York Times race report, he managed more than 100 miles per hour on the 3,000-foot backstretch and was only stopped after safety and maintenance trucks formed a barricade across the track at turn 4. But he wasn't done. When he approached by track workers, Crowder allegedly began impersonating a high schooler picking up his younger brother for the afternoon carpool.
Wait. Stop there. Wait, so so he's driving around the track, and then he pretends that he was a high schooler?
Well, this is where it's kind of the fun point of it. So he started to play a deal of locking the doors and unlocking the doors. They apparently had another set of keys. They would unlock the doors with the key, and he would lock them back. Lock, unlock, lock, unlock. This went on for about 10 minutes with police trying to get into the car. The record crowd, some 125,000 strong, cheered for Crowder, who was shirtless and hammered drunk as he was detained.
There's no way that doesn't happen without a lot of intoxication.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just love the drunk confidence. Like, you know, like maybe in the back of your head, you're like, man, it'd be so cool to drive the pace car one day. You know, maybe I'll make that a career, like as you're having a beer, you know, like a couple more beers in, you're like, man, that pace car is wide open. Maybe we can go get a close look at it or something. You know, then a couple more beers, and, you know, a couple shots later, all of a sudden your brain's like, man, we can take that pace car and we could drive off to the sunset. We could be heroes, you know. It's like the evolution of drunks, you know, like.
Funny story. That's not only the only drunk fan story of NASCAR. A few years back at their road course in New York, Watkins Glen, they had a red flag scenario where the entire field was stopped. A fan jumped over the fence and ran up to Matt Kenseth's car, screaming at him, "Hey, can I get an autograph?" while he was in the car, technically still during the race.
Oh, isn't that what the guy that Tony Stewart ran over was doing? He was like, "Hey, can I get an autograph?"
No, that was a tad different. That was
Do they
had different of an ending too? For what I understand, Matt Kenseth is like, dude, I'm kind of busy, so he ran off, and that's when the cops came running after him in the middle of the field.
The way I you know, maybe stereotype NASCAR fans, I'm surprised there's not a drunk story per week of something crazy happened. I picture dudes riding cars and taking drivers out and taking over the car, you know, like a Grand Theft Auto of NASCAR.
Well, they say like in the old days it was a lot bigger, but everybody brings their like RVs and trailers, and you can actually camp in the infields of NASCAR races. That's what one of the reasons why it got that big following in Southern Flair. But a lot of times, like, the drivers will just go out there and they'll say it's like freaking Mardi Gras going out there. The fans are just so insane. Like, every week they have a new story.
I mean, any sporting event that you're able to bring your own beer and liquor, it just generally doesn't end well. It doesn't end well because maybe that's the one good thing about, like, beer prices at, like, Yankee Stadium being insane, like, because maybe it keeps the drunkenness to a certain level. But when you're allowed to bring a cooler of 35 PBRs or Bud Ices or whatever it is, and you spent $20 to get loaded beyond belief, and you're around cars that drive 300 miles an hour, like, I'm surprised. Like, to me, statistically, someone should be dying, like, every minute. Of a NASCAR.
Maybe that's their new catchphrase next year to get more ratings. Their ratings have been low, so NASCAR, we promise death.
Dying to get in, you know. Someone dies every minute.
Keep on rewinding the footage of Dale Earnhardt Sr. It's like, look at that.
God.
NASCAR.
Well, Dale Earnhardt Jr. is done, right?
He's retired. He's mostly just an owner. He said he might do a side race here and there, but for the most part, he's done full time.
And Jeff Gordon's done, right?
Jeff Gordon's done. Tony Stewart is done.
Okay, so there's...
Most of the big names are done, so they've been struggling.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, there's the three names that the average dude, like myself, knows. You know, I know, like, Jimmy Johnson.
He's still going.
I actually know a couple guys after, like, you know, tuning into a couple races. But the average dude knows, like, 5-6 racers, and that's about it. And when three of them retire, I bet you they lose a big group of fans. And I guess it's also like golf and sports like that. What are they doing to get – it's funny because the Masters just happened, right? And there are all these amazing – like, they say golf has almost never been stronger with the young talent that's there. There's never been a pool this deep of, like, amazing golfers. But yet, mm-hmm. What happens with the Masters? Tiger Woods comes back healthy for the first time, and he is the dominant storyline for 3 out of the 4 days of the Masters. So it's like,
well, I mean,
getting new fans is a tough thing.
Well, also add to it, when you look at a golf field, you're talking about how many golfers in a day, like 80, 85. So, I mean, it's hard to – I mean, every week 80-some people are going in there, and it's usually a different person every time. So it's hard to get, like, that real true following if you don't have a consistent winner like Tiger Woods was, who had a kind of a personality. I mean, the only person I could think of who – started winning, people would go nuts at John Daly, but just because he's a partying fat guy.
Yeah, yeah, and Phil would be the other one. Phil Mickelson would be.
Well, I would debate. I mean, Phil's a great. He'll go down as one of the greatest. I'm not sure there's a golf Hall of Fame, but if there is, he's obviously going into it. But to say he would drive ratings, I think so.
If Phil,
he was getting hot when Tiger got hurt.
I think if Phil was winning, there would definitely be some tuning in. But, like, even me and my friends did a Masters pool this year for the first time. I always wanted to do it. It was pretty fun. You pick, like, two Americans, two Europeans, one past champion, and one other, like someone from another country. And the lowest score each day wins. And it was a lot of fun. And if your guy doesn't make the cut, you get the highest score of the day automatically. So it's pretty cool. I won the third day. But it was pretty cool, like, because that made me watch, like,
But there's so many good golfers, man, like that are all like under the age of like 28 years old, like 22, 23, 24. All these guys, you know, they've been playing golf since they're 8 years old.
I guess gambling will just make anybody a fan.
A fan. We each threw in $50, and I won like $250 or something like that. It was fun.
I think, like, for example, I forget where they moved from, but I think it was San Antonio. Like, a WNBA team just moved to Las Vegas, and I said, that's the most brilliant thing in the world because you're going to give away – they're owned by MGM. You know MGM's going to like, hey, how's it going? You want to go see a WNBA game? Oh, okay. By the way, it's right past that betting booth over there.
Yeah. Well,
and you know people are going to be like, oh, we'll go there for an afternoon. Oh, let's make it a little interesting. I don't know anybody in the WNBA, and I guarantee you they're going to have sellout crowds.
Not only that, like Vegas is proving that the Vegas crowds are insane. Okay, they're doing really well. Mm-hmm. There's going to be four sports there in 10 years, max 10 years. It might happen in 5 years, to be honest, because you already got football going.
Football's going. Hockey's there.
Baseball, I could easily see it happening. There's already minor league teams there, so you know it plays. Yeah. But the point
is, Miami's smart. They would move there. I mean, for God's sakes, they ain't getting any fans down there. You got a sucky team, they won't care.
Dude, when the Mets were down there last, there were 7,000 people at one game.
Mm-hmm.
7,000. There were probably 6,000 Met fans.
Yeah, that's what always happens. They get no fan. Why would they care? I mean, the one time Derek Jeter could have been cheered as a Marlins owner is if he showed up for the Yankee series, and that's only to thank him for Stanton.
Yeah, but my point was, like, gambling is so universally easily accessible with the internet. It's not like it used to be, like, you had to go to Vegas to gamble like that or be – there's so many sites and things like that. I don't think that's a problem anymore. People gamble on sports in the comfort of their own home now. It's not like you have to go get tickets in Vegas or put money down in AC in Vegas. Like, I don't think the whole gambling thing is even that big of a deterrent anymore. I think professional teams are like, who cares? There's a big market here.
Exactly. I mean, it just adds that little bit of fun, and that's what's going to get people interested. And that's why I guarantee all those crowd. I mean, Knights, they pretty much sell out every game, and they
best story.
They got
best
awesome
story
team.
In sports this year, by far.
Yeah,
best story.
Yeah,
in
the
sports.
Raiders. I mean, their fan base. They're nuts. I mean, as much as they say they ain't going to move from Oakland, they'll just be a new group that'll be insane in that stadium. And
not only
it'll
that,
just keep growing.
Not only that, the Raiders are one of those teams like the Steelers and Cowboys that have fans for all over the country. So there's gonna be fans that are there already or transplanted there or that travel to Vegas that are gigantic Raider fans to begin with, where a flight to Vegas is not that bad. So
no.
There will be I guarantee there will be probably three sports within 5 years and all four sports in Vegas in the next 10 years.
Still no team in Atlantic City yet, though, huh?
But Atlantic City's not even fun. It's like, ugh, yeah, it's so
well, that's the joke of it. Remember, it used to be like, oh, we got Atlantic City. This is so great. Now it's just like,
just the same stereotype. It's just old people hooked up to machines and degenerates. And there's no life to it, man. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's like Borgata's nice for a casino, and that's really like about it, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, Berlo, let's get out of here, man. Let's get out of here. Anything to promote?
I'll just do my Facebook page, facebook.com/TheBurl721. I'm actually going to try again with Fear the Walking Dead, try to do a couple of those, and I'm going to come up with a few more things. So, I'll be working on some things, be interesting stuff. Love to hear feedback. Facebook.com/TheBurl721.
At least you gave a nice hint of what it is. You're going to work on some things. It's going to be interesting stuff.
Well, I mean, I've been writing down some ideas, but I don't know where I'm going to go with some of these things. It could be
no
some
hints,
of the
no hints for the fans.
Did.
No hints for the millions and millions of
Burlunatics.
Burlunatics,
yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I buy a sports team, that's going to be their mascot name.
Well, I mean, buddy, if you buy a sports team, I don't expect that you'll be doing this.
You don't know. I got to promote the team, man. My double-A baseball team, you know, come on down and see the Burlunatics.
Burlu, anything to promote? Well, today it's hot dog and free admission day.
Hot dog day at Burlunatics Stadium here. We're taking on Orlando. You know that's going to be a rough match here with us Noonan Burlunatics.
The Noonan Burlunatics. Well, I'm going to promote us just because I didn't really get into it in the front end of the show. We've had a lot of great episodes over the last, you know, over the last couple of years, really. But just going back the last couple, go back last week and check out Tom Verney, retired NYPD officer, part of the LGBT community. Just a really interesting guy. That was last week. The week before, we had Dave Kalama and Terry Kirby. Dave Kalama is a big wave surfer, a stand-up paddleboarder, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The week before that, we had Andrew W.K. So there's been a lot of really good episodes. We also, under the Verbal Shenanigans name, run comedy shows and charity events. So we're just going to promote us. Follow us on Verbal Shenanigans on Instagram and Facebook. And then on Twitter, it's at VS Comedy. And subscribe and comment and rate and all that fun stuff. So that's it. So with that, life is funny. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back. Bye, Burlu.
See you.
To the poor, but I don't know the first thing about love. And moving mountains ain't no thing to me. I've faith enough to cast them to the sea, but I don't know the first thing about love. But oh.